century, a man who was enormously skilled at leading troops in battle. He was also a very unusual man. Interesting how strange many of the great generals of the Second World War were. And he was one of the strange ones. But he was a man who married late in life. He was very much under the influence of his mother for nearly all of his life. A great general who had trouble cutting his mother's apron strings. But when he did finally get married, he had a son. Son named Arthur. How'd you like to go through life, Arthur MacArthur? It just doesn't... Anyway, his son was very important to him. And with typical MacArthurian eloquence, he had lots of things to say about being a father. There was a prayer he published, and it went like this. Build me a son, Lord, who will be strong enough to know when he's weak and brave enough to face himself when he is afraid. One who will be proud and unbending in heart in honest defeat and humble and gentle in victory. Build me a son whose wishes will not take the place of deeds, a son who will know you, and that to know himself is the foundation stone of knowledge. Build me a son whose heart will be clear, whose goal will be high, a son who will master himself before he seeks to master others. And he goes on, full of eloquence, with the theme, build me a son. They're great words. They're high hopes. They are eloquent statements. I guess on one level it's kind of sad that they weren't realized. His son was overwhelmed by his father, distanced himself with him, changed his name so nobody would know he was the son of Douglas MacArthur, and lived in obscurity as a disappointment to his father for a great deal of his life. But behind that prayer is a fallacy. Build me a son, Lord. And the reality is that the Lord doesn't build sons, he gives us babies. And he calls us to be involved in the process of training and building into their lives and fathering them and mothering them and raising in them those kind of qualities. Undoubtedly, God in his grace overrules and intervenes. And the prayer to build a son is on one level an appropriate prayer, but on another level it's a transfer of responsibilities. That God has called parents. And on Father's Day, it is our reaffirmation of those fundamental truths. Peggy Noonan, in her typical, insightful way, describes an incident her brother had, being mugged by some street kids, some gang kids, who are the kind who make many parts of our cities in the United States a place of danger. And as they talked about it, he made the observation that he didn't understand all that was going on, but they seemed to be driven by rage. And Peggy Noonan picks up that idea and writes this. It is not rage at society. It is only rage directed at society. It is the rage of the loveless. And it is directed at society because it is easier, more possible, to aim their anger at an abstract thing, at a society that, as they are constantly told, wants to discriminate against them, will always discriminate against them, than at the individuals, the parents, the young, herself, unloved mother, the absent father, who left their hearts quite dead. That is why their eyes are dead, these teenagers, because their hearts are dead. They killed their hearts so they could be tough and hard, to show the world they are unfrightened and alive, because inside they know they are wounded and dead. From what I have seen, if you have a parent's love, you may or may not turn out okay. But if you've never had a parent's love, you will go through life with a parent-shaped hole inside you. And it will most likely, unless you have a very strong soul or very good luck or another power intervenes, leave you thwarted and disturbed and possibly dangerous. One of the most disturbing and yet important books that's been written recently is a book entitled Fatherless America. We're looking at the life of David. And David's a kind of ambiguous figure when you come to talking about fathering. He was no success as a father with many of his sons, although with Solomon, he was a very different kind of father. It was typical of David that he learned. And what he did with Solomon was different than what he'd done with Absalom and with Amnon and with Adonijah. But what I want to think with you about this morning is not David as a father, but David as a leader. David is a man who influenced others, because although he was not a great father, as a matter of fact, at times a very poor father, he's a very great leader. And leadership is all about influencing people, and ultimately that's what parenting is about. And I want you to think with me around the life of David, about some things that are true of effective leadership, whether it's in the home, whether it's in the community, whether it's in work, whether it's in the church context, on what other level. And from David, to learn some things about how I as a father, how I as a parent, how I as a husband, how I as a leader, how I as a mother, or whatever relationship I might have, can effectively be what God wants me to be. It is said in Psalm 78 that God chose David his servant and took him from the sheep pens. From tending the sheep he brought him to be the shepherd of his people Jacob, of Israel his inheritance. And David shepherded them with integrity of heart. With skillful hands he led them. I'd like you to turn with me to 2 Samuel. Now in the last four chapters of 2 Samuel, the writer, the historian, it takes about six different things that he wants to say about David, and he puts them together as an appendix. They're out of chronological order. They traverse different parts of his life. He wanted us to see these little pictures of David, and we looked at one of them last week from chapter 24. I want to look at chapter 21 and chapter 23 this morning, because he wanted us to see some things about David as a leader. And there are three things that I would like you to see in these two passages that talk about David the leader. 2 Samuel 21 is the first passage. If I said 23, forgive me. 2 Samuel 21, verse 15. And the first thing I want you to see about David the leader is here stated indirectly. Let's read it. 2 Samuel chapter 21, verse 15. Once again, as there were many times over in David's early rule and in his pre-rule experience when Saul was on the throne, once again there was a battle between the Philistines and Israel. David went down with his men to fight against the Philistines, and he became exhausted. And Ishbi-Benob, one of the descendants of Rapha, or the giant, whose bronze spearhead weighed 300 shekels and who was armed with a new sword, said he would kill David. But Abishai, son of Zariah, came to David's rescue. He struck the Philistine down and killed him. Then David's men swore to him, saying, "Never again will you go out with us to battle, so the lamp of Israel will not be extinguished." In the course of time, there was another battle with the Philistines at Gob. At that time, Sabbekai the Hushathite killed Soph, one of the descendants of Rapha. In another battle with the Philistines at Gob, Elhanan, son of Jaara Oregim, the Bethlehemite, killed Goliath the Gittite. Now, we've got a problem here. And there's two problems. One is there's some problems in the Hebrew of this particular verse in and of itself. And I won't go into all the textual problem there. There are three problems. The second problem is we know earlier that David killed Goliath. And in 1 Chronicles, it tells us that it was a man named Elhanan, who killed Lemmi, the brother of Goliath. And that's almost certainly what should be here. 1 Chronicles seems to have it right in this particular case. And so it is Elhanan who kills the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, who had a spear with a shaft like a weaver's rod. In still another battle, which took place at Gath, there was a huge man with six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, 24 in all. He also was descended from Rapha, the giant. When he taunted Israel, Jonathan, son of Shimeah, David's brother, killed him. These four were descendants of Rapha in Gath, and they fell at the hands of David and his men. Now, let me remind you, the Philistines were an aggressive, determined enemy. They had dominated Israel. At one point, we're told, because they not only dominated them militarily, they dominated them technologically. There were two swords in all of the nation of Israel, one belonging to Saul, one belonging to Jonathan, and the people were living in caves. And they not only dominated them, and they had this expansive empire which kept pushing and kept pushing and kept pushing, so that Israel was continually in the defensive. But they had these descendants of a giant, a kind of genetic fluke that had happened. And so Rapha, this man, sent his genetic influence into the bloodstream, and every now and then there would be this huge individual. If you think of Shaquille O'Neal, having watched the NBA playoffs this week, and recognized that Shaquille O'Neal would be to these people as I am to Shaquille O'Neal in size, you begin to get some impression these were big human beings. And they were intimidating. But what the writer of this passage wants us to know, that under David's leadership, there were men of moral fiber, men of incredible courage. So Abishai, seeing that David is vulnerable and weary, puts his own life on the line and rushes in and takes on the giant. When David is about to be killed, he intervenes and takes a sword and kills him. And then there is Sabbakai, and there is Elhanan, and there is Jonathan. Strong, heroic, committed individuals. And my question is twofold. Why are they mentioned, and where do they come from? And I think the answer is a fascinating one. Where did they come from? Well, they weren't there. And you remember David coming to Goliath, the Philistines, and the giant. 40 days, every single follower of God and follower of Saul has run back and said, we can't take him on. Every morning they would come out and sign the battle cry, and the people would run away in fear in the presence of the giant. Until one day, a teenage boy with one stone in his sling and a few in his pocket marches out and runs toward Goliath, and trusting God, kills the Goliath. One man in a nation overwhelmed by the power of the Philistines and the power of the giant. And yet, as David begins to experience the opposition of Saul, he runs and he comes to a place called the Cave of Adullam. And a group of 400 men come to him. They're described in 1 Samuel chapter 22 and verse 2. And it says they were the 3D group. They were people who were in debt, people who were distressed, or people who were discouraged. In other words, they were not the raw materials of a band that takes over. They were not the elite of the nation. They were the marginalized. They were the discouraged. They were the hopeless. And they came to David. And the point that I want you to see here is that it was out of the raw material, led by a man who himself was a giant fighter, that giant fighters emerged. I think there's a direct cause-effect relationship between one man who was willing to face a giant and four others who follow him, so that not only Goliath, but Goliath's brothers are endangered and ultimately killed. And what's my point? My point is simply this, that you don't kill giant killers by having seminars on giant killing. You don't kill giants by writing books or having lectures on how to kill giants. You kill giants because a man trusts God enough to go against the Philistines and to go against Goliath. And it wasn't the lectures of David, it was the model of David that turned Abishai and Sibbecai and Jonathan and Elhanan into men who would say, if God could help David, he can help me. And the point is, effective leadership is the leadership of men and women who risk going out, trusting God, and taking on the giants, who are willing to commit themselves. I saw it in my own father's life. There is absolutely no doubt in my life, the most influential figure in my life was my father. I saw him take on the giant of materialism. I will never forget the day. It was a significant turning point in my life, when he fought the giant of materialism and said no to a promotion to vice president of an international pharmaceutical company, because it would mean moving to a place that was not for the spiritual well-being of his family. And whatever that cost my dad financially, it got him three boys, because we saw it was real. It was my father who helped kill the giant of infidelity, because I saw his commitment to my mother. I saw the commitment he had to live a holy life and to live a wife-honoring life. And the one thing I knew in my family was that if I didn't show respect for my mother, I was in deep trouble. And he killed a few giants. He killed a few giants when he modeled servanthood and sacrificial giving, when people would phone and he would be there. He modeled and killed the giant of spiritual apathy. Because in my family, although he was a full-time pharmacist and employee, all his life, he was far more a full-time Christ follower. And we learn from infancy. I went to church before I was born, and I watched him serve in every conceivable way, from singing to leading music to preaching to serving in the church to starting different organizations. And my father killed forever the giant of spiritual apathy because I saw in him, with all of his imperfections, and I'm an expert on his imperfections, but I saw a man who put a stone in a sling and went out to some of the most significant issues of life, and I saw that in my father. And whatever else I knew the power of model and the power of example. I was struck this week in reading through a book on leadership, and in it, the manager of Lockheed Missiles and Space Company tells about his days as a high school football player, and I'll just quote what he writes. He said, "When I played high school football, I had three coaches. The first two were exactly alike. Each said, 'Men, while you're training, I don't want you to smoke, drink, stay up late, or fool around with girls.' Got that? Then we would watch our coaches during the season. They would smoke, drink, stay up late, and fool around with women. So what do you suppose we did? Boys will be boys, after all. My third coach was the best I ever had. At the beginning of the season, we had the same locker room sermon as all the other coaches, except this coach just said, 'Man, I have only one rule. You can do anything I do. If I smoke, drink, stay up late, or fool around with women, then I would expect you to do the same. But if I don't, you better not.' That was the most difficult season I ever played, football. The guy was a regular saint." Fathers, it is the power of our model that will turn our children into people who can live in a time when Philistines and giants are in the land. And these are not inconsequential. Drug abuse, sexual promiscuity, sexual diseases, materialism, all of those are far more life-destructive than Goliath. And if our children don't see in us men who will engage the issues of our day and say, "Trusting God, I'll deal with the giants," we'll never breed giant killers. But when an Elhanan sees a David take on a Goliath, then all of a sudden, Goliath's brother doesn't look so big. And that's true in every area of our life. Effective leaders, effective parents, model the reality of faith and the reality of holiness in their lives as they seek to live for God. We live in a society that has confused fame and greatness. Fame is the product, sometimes just of a moment. Greatness is the longevity of a life well lived. I'd rather be great in those terms than famous in the world's terms. David shaped lives because he dared to trust God, and he modeled. Second thing I'd like you to look at is over in chapter 23. Second thing about effective leaders that overlaps into being an effective parent is something about David's heart. There's a fascinating story, and I'm jumping into the middle, and we'll go back and read the parts that surround it in just a moment. But it says in verse 13, during harvest time, three of the 30 chief men, this is David's military cadre, the band of people who surrounded him, three of the 30 chief men came down to David at the cave of Adullam. Now, we're not quite sure when this is. It may have been when he was running from Saul. It may have been while he was king at an early stage and the Philistines had overrun the land and he was beginning to push them out. The time is not nearly so important as the structure of the problem. Well, a band of Philistines was encamped in the valley of Rephaim, that is south and slightly to the west of Jerusalem, and the Philistine garrison was at Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem was David's hometown. It was a place he knew and cared for. And there was a longing in his heart for two things. One was there was a kind of nostalgia for Bethlehem. Living in a cave wasn't nearly as good as living in his hometown. And there was also a sense, if only I could drink of the well of Bethlehem. He longs for the refreshment and this nostalgia of how good it would be to be out of this smelly cave, collecting water, stale and not always fresh and good tasting. But there was also a sense, if I could drink out of the well of Bethlehem, it would be free. But two things are true. That is, the garrison is there, and the two things a garrison will always do is guard the gate of the city and guard the water supply. You can visit the Middle East today and travel around the archaeology of the cities of Israel will nearly always spend a long time talking about how the gate was defensed, because it was the key to the city. Well, David is there one day, and he just expresses a wish. And he says, I wish someone would get me a drink of water from the well of the gate of Bethlehem. I don't know, it was one of those off moments. He was just sitting there, just like you would in a hot day, and say, I wish we could get a jar of kind of tea my mother used to make. You don't mean anything by it. Just the wish. It's just something that you say, and you get on with life. He wasn't pining, and he wasn't implying anything. But three of his men hear that. And when three of his men hear that, they're close enough to know his wishes. But more remarkably, one of them nudges the other and says, let's do it. Let's do it for the chief. So they go. It isn't described in any great detail in verse 16. It just says, so the three mighty men broke through the Philistine lines, drew water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem, and carried it back to David. Can you imagine what that cost, though? Surreptitiously making their way through the enemy, coming up against the lines, moving around in between, and then, because there was no way they could do this surreptitiously, taking on the hosts of the Philistines who wouldn't be expecting them, and driving through, risking their lives, scooping out water, all of a sudden rushing away, and as they're going the 7 miles back to the cave of Adullam, guarding that water carefully because they're going to give it to the chief, worrying that it's getting a little warm, wanting to present it as fresh as they can, and at the same time worrying about who's following them, they rush back to the presence of David and they say, here it is, David, here it is. And David holds it in his hands. And David looks at his men, and a sense of wonder and awe comes over his face. And as the awe covers his face, he thinks about the devotion. Here are men close enough to hear my wishes, and here are men committed enough to risk their lives for me. And all of a sudden, that water in David's hands turns into a holy thing. And he takes it, and he pours it out on the ground. How do you explain that to those three fellas? Look at the words he uses at the end of verse 16. He refused to drink it. Instead, he poured it out before or to the Lord. Far be it from me, O Lord, to do this, he said. Isn't this not the blood of the man who went at the risk of their lives? This isn't just water. This is blood. And as he poured it out, he turned a precious thing into a holy thing. He didn't pour it on the ground to say, I wouldn't drink this. He poured it to the Lord. See, there was in Israel what was called the drink offering. Every time a sacrifice would be offered, wine would be added to the sacrifice and poured out at the burnt offering, and it would be poured out to the Lord as a sense of that which is valuable and special is being given over to the Lord. On very rare occasions, it would be oil. But now David takes water, and he turns water into something holy and precious and makes it an offering to God himself. And what he has in fact done and said, this is too precious to be given to me. It is to be given to the Lord. Now let's step back and think, what's going on in David's heart? First thing I want you to sense is his sensitivity to his men. He doesn't take their sacrifice for granted. He's not a celebrity who says, well, that's the way you should be treated. I mean, we live in a world, we know it. When you've got power, you want the perks of power. People do things for you. People defer to you. They open doors for you, and you begin to expect that. And it can happen in Christian leadership as well. You can begin to expect that because you're in leadership, people should do these things for you. And you begin to feel like a celebrity, or because you're in work and you've got a particular position, you begin to think, well, these are my perks. People should treat me this way. As these men came to David, he said, no, this isn't something that you offer to a man. This isn't something that is just given to a person. What you've done, man, is so sacred and special. And he's not despising it by pouring it out. He's saying, I'm not worthy of this. And you get his heart devotion to the Lord. That rather than saying, I'm worthy, he's saying, Lord, you're the only person who's worthy of sacrifice. You're the only person who's worthy of service like this. These people haven't done it for me. They've done it for you, and I want to honor you in this. And I am convinced as those men saw the devotion of David's heart, they were powerfully impacted because they realized a leader who's more concerned about service to the Lord is a safe leader to serve. Because when a person's concerned about service to them, he'll use you and manipulate you and twist you. But when a person realizes that things done for them are to be sacredly treated as acts of worship done to the Lord, then he's worthy of serving. He's worthy of devotion. That's true of parenting as well. My children need to see in me a devotion to the Lord that transcends every other devotion. They need to recognize that serving the Lord God is the burning passion of my heart. That Christ being Christ and Jesus being Lord. So it affects the way I treat my children, and it affects the way I treat my wife, and it affects the way in which I live my work life, and it affects the way in which I spend my money. Because, Lord, you are Lord, and nothing given to me could ever recompense for what you've done for me. And so even the most precious acts of service that people give, I want to lay before you. Effective leaders in the cause of Jesus Christ never forget who's in charge. They don't raise their children for themselves. They raise their children for the Lord. They don't live their lives for themselves. They live it for the Lord. They don't live their lives for their wives and for their retirement. They live their lives for their Lord. They don't live their lives to cocoon and cluster. They live their lives for the kingdom, to make a difference for the cause of Christ. Effective leaders model. Effective leaders inspire by devotion. Now look a little bit earlier. Third thing I want you to notice is David, who leads with a heart of integrity, is a man who built a company of the committed. We don't have time to go through the list in any depth, but beginning at verse 8, we get a roster of David's men. They're called David's mighty men, men of skill, men of ability, men of strength. They're organized in three different groups. There's the three, the leaders, the elite group. Then there's two men who are signaled out as men who are in some way above the three, and yet they somehow rank below the three. They're men of special valor and commitment. And then there's the 30. That's kind of a title that, there's not precisely 30 because people would shift in and out of it. It's like a Roman centurion had name meant he was over 100, but they didn't worry about counting the numbers. It was an approximation. There's something striking in the list is given at all. You see, in the ancient Near East, everything was attributed to the king. And David lists the record of other people. He shares the credit. And these were people who had been with David long term. They'd been committed with him from the cave of Adullam when they were in debt, distressed, and discouraged, all the way through the time when he becomes king and all the way through his reign. And let's just meet them a bit. First one's in verse 8. His name is Joshib, Bashabeth. He was chief of the three. This is the man who was the elite chief of staff of David's armed services. The kind of man he is, you can tell. He raised his spear against 800 men whom he killed in one encounter. I can't explain that. I can't describe that. How do you kill 800 men? They line up one by one and come at... I have no idea how he did it, but it gives you a sense of the quality of this man. Man who was an incredibly gifted warrior. There was Eleazar, son of Dodai, the Ahahite, one of the three mighty men. He was with David when they taunted the Philistines. Not wise practice, but David was maybe trying to get back at Goliath, who used to taunt the Israelites. Well, now he's taunting the Philistines. And the Philistines get mad. And the men of Israel retreat. But David and Eleazar stand their ground. And it says, he stood his ground and struck down the Philistines until his hand grew tired and froze to the sword. The Lord brought about a great victory that day. The troops returned to Eleazar, but only to strip the dead. Man who could stand with his chief and stand virtually alone against the enemy, determined to hang on because his hand was virtually paralyzed as the enemy came. And then there's a man named Shammah, another man of skill and ability. When the Philistines gathered together at a place where there was a field full of lentils, they're going to raid the harvest. Israel's troops fled from them. And there's always those who will flee, but Shammah took a stand in the middle of the field. He defended it and struck the Philistines down, and the Lord brought about a great victory. And David gathers together Joshua and Eleazar and Shammah and says, "This is my elite group." But the next group's not much different. If you look at verse 18, Abishai, the brother of Joab, son of Zeruiah, was chief of the three. This is David's half-nephew, and he's with David all the way through his life. He raised a spear against 300 men whom he killed, and he became as famous as the three. Would he not held in greater honor than the three? He became their commander, even though he was not included among them. That's a little bit obscure, but the point is, here's another great man, and then Benaiah. Benaiah has three exploits. He was a valiant fighter from Kabzeel who performed great exploits. He struck down two of Moab's best men. I mean, here they are, the point men of Moab's army, lions. That's the term that's used, lions of their god. And Moab takes them on, and Benaiah takes them on and he kills them. And then there was the day he went down to a pit on a snowy day and there was a lion down there. Maybe intimidating the area, whatever it was. I don't want to fight lions, and I certainly don't want to fight lions in a pit where I can't get out. And on a snowy day when he's got home field advantage because four legs are a lot better than two when it's snowing. But Benaiah goes down to the pit and takes on the lion and kills the lion. And then it said further of him, he struck down a huge Egyptian. Although the Egyptian had a spear in his hand from the Egyptian, Benaiah went against him with a club. He snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. Such were the exploits of Benaiah. He was held in greater honor than any of the 30, but he was not included among the three. And David put him in charge of the bodyguard. And then we get the roster beginning in verse 24. Among the 30 were Azahel, Elhanan, and on we go. I'm not going to read the list of the 30. What's the point? David surrounded himself with strong, committed people. People of strength, people of ability. David didn't do what he did on his own. They were in debt, distressed, and discouraged, but David built together a team of men because David understood that you can only lead effectively and you can only be effective in the context of the fellowship of the committed. A company of people of like heart and a commitment to serve God. And the glue that held these people together was a sense of mission. Sense of commitment to God and His purposes. To make David king. But more than that, to do God's will and God's work. And as they gathered together to make David king, they knew that they were doing the will and work of God. They were people who shared a passion and people who shared a mission. How does that affect me? Just simply this. One of the greatest blessings of my life was my parents were committed to being part of the company of the committed. I wasn't raised in a Christian home in isolation. We had through our home by deliberate intent of my parents Christian leaders and Christian workers and friends. My parents went out of their way to make sure I had exposure to men and women who knew what it was, trusting God to have gone into a pit on a snowy day and fought a lion for God. I remember listening to men who started Far East Broadcasting Company sitting at my table, and the man who started HCJB in Ecuador sitting at our table, and people who served God and ministered in different ways. And around that table, as I listened to members of the Company of the Committed, a fire was lit in my heart that if these are God's people, I want to be part of them. And as I look back, I went back last September to take the funeral of my aunt. And as I looked at those white-haired saints gathered around to say farewell to my aunt, the thing that was in my heart, knowing that I would not see many of them and hadn't seen them since my father's funeral, but I looked back at my youth and I couldn't help but think, I sat around the table with many of these dear people and they nourished me and they cared for me because they were part of the Company of the Committed. And wise parents don't try to lead in a vacuum. And one of our commitments is parents has been to try and get our kids into places where they would meet God's mighty men and it would rub off on them. I wish the list didn't end the way it ended. But look at the list. Look at verse 24. Among the 30 were, and then it's all numbered. And then look at verse 39. Well, verse 38. It was Ira, the Ithrite. Korab, the Ithrite. And Uriah, the Hittite. Why? Why does he place it last where you can hardly miss it? Why didn't he bury it in the middle? Uriah the Hittite. What do you think of when you hear that name, Uriah the Hittite? I think of David's failure. I think of David's sin. I think of that moment when David went and took Uriah's wife. And here I learned it wasn't just that he took another man's wife. Uriah the Hittite was one of his mighty men. I mean, he betrayed one of his closest friends. Why does the sacred historian not just conveniently forget Uriah was on the list? And why does he put it last? I don't know all of his reasons. I do know what I learned from this. I am reminded by this that even the greatest of human leaders will fail. David may have mighty men and he may be part of the Company of the Committed. But David will take the devotion of a Uriah and he will throw it in the dust and walk all over it because of the sinfulness of his heart. And ultimately it reminds me that it isn't David, it's only David's Lord who's worthy of the deepest devotion of my heart. Your parent will do that to you. You believe your parent is worthy of being the ultimate model for your life and you'll find a Uriah in your parents list some. Oh, it may have nothing to do with sex. The great reminder is that we need not David's heart, but David's Lord as the ultimate anchor of our life. And fathers, our greatest need is to come and not listen to the sermon and say, I want to be like David. It is to bring ourselves to the foot of the cross and say, oh, David's Lord, who died for me on the cross, David's son, descendant of David, but son of God, make me a man of integrity. Make me a man of God. The wonderful thing is that there's still a Uriah in his list, but David is still, because he's forgiven and brought it before the Lord, a man whom God has used. Uriahs and all, God used him because David came to the cross. And men, some of us already have the Uriah on our list. And the greatest thing that we can do for our children is to do what David did. And that is to come with an open heart and to say, Lord, The Uriah's there. All I can do is tell my children that the Uriah was there, but God forgave me. But don't walk the way of David and Uriah. And some of us need to come with a renewal of our heart before the Lord and say, "Oh Lord, keep me from the blunder. Keep me from the blunder of David." Because effective as he was, it's only you. And David, unaided, could blunder. Only you can keep me in holiness. An effective leader models. Dares to trust God and walk out against the Philistines and giants. An effective leader worships and recognizes nothing is worthy of devotion that only belongs to the Lord. An effective leader rallies and builds a fellowship of the committed to support and encourage and sustain. And an effective leader humbles and confesses, because he knows that if his children or his followers get his eye on him, there's always going to be a Uriah. And so we walk with a brokenheartedness before the Lord, a humility that says, "Lord, help me. Help me to deal with the Uriah and keep me from any more." Would you bow with me in prayer? Father, I would ask that as we are in your presence this morning, we would recommit ourselves to being who you want us to be for your glory. And I pray especially on this Father's Day for those of us who are men. I pray that for some of us, because of Uriah's in our life, we need to begin again. For others of us, our life, because of the weakness of our heart, we need to commit again. And not a single one of us doesn't need to refocus again. I pray that you'd enable us to do that. Pray that the words we now sing might be the prayer of our hearts. In Christ's name, amen.